history. Today's date is November 29, 1972. The time is 3:30 p.m. I will be interviewing Mr. Norman Osborne of Saginaw, Michigan. Mr. Osborne is labor staff representative of the Saginaw United Way. He is also active in such organizations as the NAACP and the National Boy Scouts of America. Mr. Osborne is a member of Bethel AME Church and also a lifelong resident of the Saginaw area. The topic to be discussed today is some of the contributions made by the black people in the formation of the Saginaw area. Good afternoon, Mr. Osborne.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Osborne, to begin with, perhaps we should get a little history of your parents. You were born here in Saginaw. Was your parents born here?
My mother was, but not my father.
Exactly when did he come to Saginaw, and what was the nature of his coming?
My father came from Trinidad, worked his way through Panama Canal, and for labor he worked all the way up through the United States, through Wisconsin, and then came on into Michigan, into Saginaw.
And he was coming to Saginaw looking
for work.
For work.
Yes, he was.
What position did your father hold at that time here in Saginaw?
My father first started working with a Corbett moving company as a truck mechanic, and then later on as a driver. But back in those days, around 1911, 1912, automobiles were quite a rarity, and he had skills as an auto mechanic, which was something rare in those days. It would be equivalent now to a TV technician in this present day. But he's that far advanced, and that was what he came to work as with Corbett Trucking Company, Moving Company.
And you and your brothers and sisters grew up here. I wonder what was it like, noting that there was only a few blacks in this area at that time, what exactly was it like to grow up here in Saginaw?
Well, in our day, we didn't even give any consideration. We were just youngsters, and among the group, I was the first black born, I was first black raised in the first so-called first ward, because I was born out on Helena Street, which used to be outside of city limits, which is presently 17th Street, inside the city limits.
I see.
And then we were moved, my father purchased a home in the first ward as the first blacks to live there. And so being the first black child to attend Potter School and being surrounded with neighbors as they were, it was nothing new, it was just an ordinary sort of thing. On Sundays, we met with the other blacks, as you use the term nowadays, from the other parts of the city, and we formed and gathered at the old AME Church property behind which is now Sears Roebuck parking lot. That was our first church, but that was our place that we met, and that was when we saw others of our racial group. But being separate and apart, we never even gave it a thought. We just wanted the kids in the neighborhood.
Then you could say that you could see no discrimination on anyone's part towards you or your family at that time?
Well, if it did, it wasn't such as it was, wouldn't even notice. We never gave it a thought. Discrimination as such, we didn't even consider maybe until we got a little older, because we didn't realize that if there was, that was any such thing as that happening.
About how many black families was there in this general area at that time?
Well, let's see, I'll have to go by names. There was the Williams family over on 13th Street. My grandmother and my cousins lived over on 17th. The Lewises lived on 18th. The Pondexters lived on 18th. You had to count them as I go along. The Pearsons lived out on Wadsworth. And then come back across the tracks is the DeGrosse on 12th Street. Harry Brown family, the Undertaker, his family lived on South 12th. There were the Calloways lived on South 11th. Mrs. Inman lived over where Central Junior High School is now, presently. When we come back, there were the Fords and the DeGroats lived over on Federal Street, the old DeGroats and the Ford family, and the Hall on 7th Street, 7th and Federal. That's the way I had to go by just names. Mm-hmm. That was about the roughly on the east side. The rest were on the west side, the Porterfields, the Burdens, and the Burdens out in the south end. And then there were a couple other families out in the south end, which we call South Washington. I had to go by memory on this. That would be, and the Haythcoles lived on the west side. So they were very, and the Woodwards. So as you see, I can almost call the names of all those. So if we don't, whenever we walked down the street, we knew who was on the street. Mm-hmm. It was one of those sort of situations.
Okay, what sort of work was available at that time for the general area? You know, what industry was popular?
Well, most of the people at that time had jobs of their own. For instance, the Porterfields, they worked partly in the farm, then they went into the garage business. Mr. Woodward was, he worked in housework as a driver of carriages. Mr. Ford was a plasterer. Mr. DeGroat and Mr. Hall worked at the tannery, the old Carlisle tannery. Mr. Williams worked at the old Saginaw foundries as a truck driver. Mr. Lewis, he had his own dray wagon. So mostly there was no one certain large place that hired the whole group. Each one more or less had his own. And oh yes, I forgot, the Atwoods used to live down in South Jefferson, were some of the richest Negroes. But they had their own, he was the mail carrier, and then they had a business of their own. But there were no large group of people working in any one place. Mm-hmm. Mr. Robinson had a garage, as Mr. John Robinson had a garage out here on Johnson Street.
Okay, then at that time you could say that the blacks in this area was as skilled as the rest of the populace.
Right, that is right. Because you'd even date way back to your lumbering days. We had black foremen when Sagan was in his lumbering days. Mm-hmm. And the Goodrich family that did the photography work for the history of old Saginaw, those were black men, the Goodrich brothers. Mm. So a lot of people, when you talk about old history of Saginaw, the old pictures was done by black photographers.
Okay.
Kind of shook you up a little bit, eh?
What stage did we begin to get an influx of the Negro into this area and began to get a stereotyping of him as being unskilled and manually inclined?
This is one of my most telling parts. Back in the late 20s, the General Motors foundry on 6th and Washington called for an expansion. They had hired Mexican and they'd hired some of the unskilled workers of the other racial groups, but they needed more help. So they went on a recruiting drive in the late 20s down to the Southland to recruit men. Men were paid for the number of men that they brought up. And we know, and you know as well as anyone, that when they went to go to get recruiting, they would not go to an established home. They go to the pool rooms and places of this type because they were being paid by the number of men that were coming up here. So the established family man there would be no inducement for him to come. So this is where they brought them up in boxcars. And to fill in the foundry, working conditions being like they were, if a man fell out with heat, he was laid out on the grass and it'd take another man and replaced him. And they put him in bunkhouses in the foundry, and that was the time that this was a group of men who were being paid these wages. There was no inducement for families to come in. A family man was no inducement for him. They were interested in just the man that coming in and work. He'd get tired, he'd go and leave, and another man come in. Houses were not available for rent even, and none for purchase. So the foundry established bunkhouses for them because the people that owned houses in the area did not have them for rent or were there vacancies. And when a Negro wanted to buy a house, he had to finally go in and wait until the houses had been milked dry from renters, because the real estate men moved in, bought up a bunch of the houses, and rented them out, and they're renting them out by the number of rooms. So that was where the hotbed theory came in.
Mr. Osborne, you had mentioned the hotbed theory that became prevalent at this time. Would you expound on that?
All right, the hotbed theory was there's a shortage of room space available for men to work and the men were coming in and leaving so fast that the houses were rented according to the number of rooms that were available. And the person that rented the house, he would rent a room with the beds. The men had worked three shifts. There's such a shortage. One shift men sleep, and the other two men would be in other words, he work a shift and come back in, and the other men get out of the bed and the other one move in. And this way, for the landlord, he made a pretty good profit on it. And the people that owned the house, they were capitalizing on the number of beds that so the rent was escalated almost at one time. We won't come out with facts, we can't come out and swear to it, but we do know this is one of the things that was actually happening. And so when the houses were finally put up for sale, they had gotten all the money that they could have gotten from the houses. Then that was when people wanted to buy houses were able to buy the house after they had been milked, should I say, dry financially.
At this time, would the landlords be living in this house, or are they?
They were mostly all absentee landlords.
I see.
And then the person then renting the house, he would be renting from the absentee landlord, and then he in turn would rent the rooms. And the landlord that owned the house was charging for the rent from the person that was renting according to the number of rooms. So there's escalated prices, which were kept under cover as to what the house rented for. But the man that was in the house, he is the one that started the first, but the top man is the one that profiteered, really raked the cream off the top.
I see.
And our people were subjected to this.
Where were they mostly employed?
They were mostly employed at Chevrolet Gray Iron. The malleable iron out on Central, they call now the Central Foundry, did not go in for the large number of hiring because they had, usually most of them were old-timers of the ethnic groups, the Polish, the Russian, and the old family. They kept them over at malleable iron and they didn't have the big turnover. They didn't go into the expansion. It turned out to be Chevrolet Gray Iron. It used to be called the Saginaw Central Foundry, I think that's what it used to be called. Saginaw Central Foundry, Saginaw Gray Iron Foundry, I don't remember. It used to have the name on the stack. Oh, Saginaw Products Company. That was the name of it on the smokestack.
And this was around the 1940s?
No, 1929 and 1930s.
Oh.
That's when the big influx came.
Was there very many black skilled people working in these foundries at that time?
A skilled black was not, first of all, he was there, did all they could to keep from hiring him. Because his job was to stay and do the menial labor, and that was what he was hired for. They didn't care about your scholastic ability. In fact, at that time, it was best not to state your scholastic ability, because if you had anything about third or fourth grade education, according to their records, you were classed as a troublemaker, and they didn't want you in there. So the smaller amount of knowledge that you had, the better you had a chance of being employed, even though they were short of men at the time.
I see. At that time, how was the situation concerning schools in Saginaw? It would appear that it would be mostly predominated by whites. Was there any difficulties in the learning situations at that time?
No, you had the same, the being predominantly white at the time, as that there's no school problems whatsoever. You had the same access to the same learning that the whites had, the same teaching, I should say, as the whites. And you got to realize that this was a group of men that were coming in, not family men. The families didn't come in until the late 30s, before the families were encouraged, or men that were able to start raising families. There's no encouragement for a family man to come. So the schools were not, overcrowded at the time.
Well, then in fact, they encouraged a great deal of turnover. They didn't expect for these people to continue at this job.
Right. At that time they had the big layoffs. The plants would work, rush, long hours, overtime, the next thing they would close down for months at a time. So there's nothing encouraging for stability as far as the plant was concerned.
Okay. This is the time, is this the stage in Saginaw history where you would state that the Negro actually became an important factor in the business as a whole?
He became a factor when it came to the purchasing power. The man had been working 6 and 7 days a week, and some of them were almost too tired to go downtown. Whenever he did go down, he would have large amounts of money at that time to spend. And so this is where a lot of the profiteering came in. But as far as him speaking up and going as a unified buyer, he didn't. He went as an individual buyer. But he had a potential. It was so much potential that a lot of the so-called get-rich-quick scheme people would just descend on the weekends, on paydays, and take advantage of our people.
Would he have difficulties, let's say, if he went to buy a house in the general Saginaw area, would he meet any sort of obstacles that normally people doesn't meet?
He certainly would. They discouraged his buying as much as possible. In fact, they even got to the point that there was very few homes available. The realtors or the people that were buying would grab up the homes as the other racial group left, and they would get them and they'd get them just for rental purposes, not for sale, because they were doing the profiteering. And for a man to individually buy a home, it was very much discouraged. And I think the first breakthrough came in when they started selling some of their bunk houses and some of the smaller houses the foundry had, started selling, making them available to people. I think that was one of the first breakthroughs as far as home purchasing.
Have you had any difficulties very early in purchasing or getting a house in a particular area in Saginaw?
Yes, would you believe, being born here in Saginaw, even though my father had gone into moving business on his own, had established credit rating enough to buy 7 new trucks, that I was his descendant, that I worked steadily in the plant, and I could not purchase a home anywhere I wanted to. I had property on 17th that was willed me. I couldn't buy on it because they had find so many things were wrong with it. And I went to different lending institutions, and I could not get it. And I, would you believe, also I'm the first black in Saginaw to have been able to purchase an FHA home built from the ground up. And at the time I purchased, FHA loans were only available to blacks that had expended all their money in partially building, and then they could apply, and then they come under a different type of loan. But for a home from the ground up, it was an impossibility. And we had an awful lot of trouble, and I was the first one after my breakthrough, with the use of a lawyer, then that was when we actually got FHA from the ground up homes. Yes, I had a lot of trouble.
And at this time you was thinking of buying in what particular area of Saginaw?
Well, I was in the area near which I was born, where I'm presently living. I did not care to live where I was raised, over in the First Ward area.
And this area is?
Is over here on Tuscola Street.
Tuscola Street.
Off of 14th, which is about 3 blocks from the spot I was born.
And how did you go about overcoming this?
Well, first of all, it might be interesting. You talk about the Goodrich brothers, the former photographers. Their daughter lived next door to where I'm presently living. And while I was going to high school, this daughter married a tailor, a dry cleaner. And when I was going to high school, I worked for them. And then after I married, we adopted a youngster. And they had the property in which I'm living, and they made it possible for us to get this lot next to them. That's part of the Goodrich family's, this is part of Mrs. Goodrich's, the mother of this lady. She made it possible for us to get this land in which I purchased and where I built my house.
Mm-hmm. If we had to mention some of the first professional black people in this area that became important, who would you indicate?
Well, my first one, I go back to what my mother was telling about. We had a lady by the name of Madam Walker. She had a beauty shop down here on across from our old auditorium back when my mother was a little girl. Of course, she dealt doing beauty work mostly for the other racial group, but she was a very successful businesswoman. Then the Goodrich brothers, then the Atwood brothers. I think they were professionals as business. I think they were in law, and I don't remember what else they were doing. But they were, I think they had one of their sisters was a school teacher. I think it was, if I remember right. And that was way back in the 1800s. So we've had business people right along all the way through the
Who was the brothers that helped wire the Temple Theater?
That was a Goodrich. That was the son of the Goodrich brother, the photographers. That was the brother of the lady that made it possible for us to buy the property in which I'm living. But that was one of their sons.
Some of the more recent blacks, such as our lawyers and doctors that we had here in the 1940s, perhaps early 1950s. Could you mention some of those people?
Well, we started with one of our top lawyers back in the 20s, the late 20s, early 30s, is Lawyer Jackson. He finished his law work when he was working at our Woolworth's dime store down here as a janitor. And he'd work there at nights and go to school. I mean, he'd work in the daytime and go to school at nights. And he got in, passed his bar examination while working at Woolworth's. He was 1930-31. Then we had a Dr. Chappelle, that is our first black doctor, if I remember right. He came in also as a doctor, medical doctor. Then we had a lawyer Davis, Attorney Davis, came in around 32-33. But of course, then we had a Dr. Sumby, Sidney Sumby, in 34, I think it was 33-34. Then Dr. Ulysses Bagley came around about that time. And then further on up to the rest of our doctors. But the point was made that we do know that through the Bar Association and also through the Medical Association, the doctors that came into the territory and the attorneys had to clear through them before they could establish practices. We've had other attorneys and other doctors. These are the first ones that come to my mind is the first.
And did these doctors set up practitioners in the general community or?
Attorney Davis and Dr. Chappelle set up a Third and Kirk at that time, which was more or less on the outskirts of the black community at that time. But later on, the community involved them, which was the first ward, where our present sportsman club is now. But Attorney Davis, Dr. Chappelle, and a little later on, Attorney Jackson. It was Jackson and Davis first, and Dr. Chappelle. That was their first office space. But then the others all had their business throughout the town when I come in. I was talking about the early 1800s. These people were around in East Side here.
Dr. Bagley has been credited with doing a great deal for the black community here in Saginaw. At what time was he doing most of his work?
From 1933 right up until his death. I don't remember the year of his passing, but Dr. Bagley is one of the few doctors that had, well, the other doctors did a good job too, but Dr. Bagley was a community-minded man. He spent many dollars out of his own personal pocket for community affairs. He's spent lots of time with people, and he was really a community-minded person, and many a person in this present community that they were to admit it, some of the older ones, if it wasn't for him, they wouldn't still be here.
Okay. Most of his work was done with just ordinary people, people working in the foundries that couldn't always pay,
right,
or didn't always have the cash to pay with.
Right, and Dr. Bagley, were he to have received the money that were owed him, he would have died pretty near a millionaire. I'm just stating that the money that was actually owed him. And he was one of the few doctors that didn't, when the call was made, he didn't ask you if you had any money or would you pay. He made the call late at night, early in the morning, anytime he called. And of course, many cases, the people that owed him were the ones that talked the most about him. But were they to have paid his bills and paid the debts, he would have been financially well off.
And probably after him, our most prominent doctor would be Dr. Clater, would you say?
Right.
That
Dr. Clater came in during that time, and Dr. Clater was quite a humanitarian. And he worked along also with Dr. Bagley, but he worked in a little different field, but they were both, I would say, I had a lot to do with Price Community Affairs.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that Dr. Clater was probably working in a little different field. He was, where would he differ, would you say?
Well, Dr. Clater worked, he worked through the hospital level, and he made it possible for to break the racial barriers in the hospital. Where Bagley would be working with a common ordinary man in the street, Clater was fighting our battle in the hospitals. When they were even training nurses, we did not have any black girls could even get training here in Saginaw. We had girls to get training as nurses, they had to go out of Saginaw to get training. Then they would hire him. But through his fighting, they were able to get jobs. And the doctors are even serving internships. Clater fought awfully hard to get a doctor recognized. In fact, he had to fight almost a one-man battle even to, I've heard, not being a doctor, I've heard that he even had to fight a one-man battle to even work in the surgery room. Things are that bad here.
And even today is somewhat evident in that we, I don't know, probably have about 5 or 6 doctors, Negro doctors in the Saginaw area now, where the community could use many more if they were available, I think.
Well, again, they've been told, we've been told that still subject to the medical association, just the number of doctors that can come into the community. But we do know nationally that there is a shortage of doctors all over. So if they wanted to document it, they could always come up with the facts that there is a shortage of doctors, which we, as a layperson, we couldn't contend that they were not right.
Mm-hmm. In the area of law and law enforcement, could we or would we start with probably Lawyer Marsh, who was later to become mayor? Was there people before him that was prominent?
Attorney Jackson was our first black attorney. And with the crime rate back in those days, he was known pretty well as the attorney that could take care of most of the criminal cases. And Attorney Jackson, I think, was our forerunner in the political arena, and also in the professional arena, that made himself known in the courthouse. Attorney Davis was a paper and pen man. Attorney Jackson was a floor attorney, and he was known pretty well. So that's long before Attorney Marsh came on the picture, because we had another attorney, I can't think, we've had other attorneys that have come and gone between Davis and Jackson before Marsh came on the scene.
But, some of the things that Attorney Marsh has done with him becoming mayor would probably put him in the limelight now as being one of our most prominent citizens in the field of law enforcement and probably in the black community as a whole.
Well, you're talking about law enforcement. I'm taking a different connotation. You'd say the law, we would say not enforcement as such, but as, should we say, interpreting the law. Because back in law enforcement, we talk about our early policemen.
Right.
Our Cal Nicholson that started back in the early 30s as our first black policeman as enforcing. But for interpreting law and for the honors due, I think Attorney Marsh, I'm taking nothing from what he's done. He came in at the right time, but I think back in the old days, the other attorneys worked just as hard, if not harder, but the time wasn't right for them to have gotten the recognition that he has gotten.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Cal Nicholson. Exactly what was his position and here in Saginaw, and at what time?
Cal Nicholson started around 1930 when we had this 30-31, when we had the influx of blacks. I'm saying just roughly about the date. I don't have the date in the chronological orders. But he was the first one that was appointed as a patrolman. It was due to pressure in the community for a black policeman. And he was our first patrolman that was appointed. And he came in, and he had already been in town working around here. And so he was the first appointed patrolman. And he worked up from patrolman to detective. And I don't know whether he even carried the rate of sergeant, but he was well-respected and well-liked in the police force. And when our younger policemen came in, they were welcomed by him personally into the force. Even though at the present day, we do not have a black sergeant.
Mm-hmm.